Lifestyle and Way Race Podcasts. I'm John Kinston, and this is episode 93. To the West Highland Way Race Podcasts. It's only been a couple of days since I did the last one, but I thought I'd like to get this one out pretty quickly. Last night I had the great privilege of chatting to James Stewart, the 2016 West Highland Way winner. James has got a great story, great win, and it was great to chat to him last night about his training and his running and how the race went, and get a real insight into what it's like to race at the sharp end of the race. And it was some race from his description. I also put on Facebook that I was doing the interview and asked for some questions, and we got some cracking questions, and James answered each and every one of them. So if you asked a question, then that will be on this podcast as well. It's now Wednesday, the 22nd of June, 2016, so it's just a few days after the end of the West Highland Way Race. As I say, I wanted to get this podcast out pretty quickly because I'm sure lots of people would like to hear James's story of what it's like to run the West Highland Way in 15 hours, 15 minutes and 59 seconds. So well done to James, and I hope you enjoy this interview with him. For our latest West Highland Way Race podcast, it's a great privilege to have the 2016 race winner, James Stewart. James ran the race on Saturday in an amazing 15 hours, 15 minutes and 59 seconds. So welcome, James. Very kind of you to chat to us so close to the race. And a number of people will know you, but I'm sure some people listening to this podcast have only heard your name and seen this guy. So first of all, could you just tell us just a little bit about yourself, about your family, what you do, sort of maybe non-running wise?
Yeah, no. So thanks for having me on. It's great to be here, and I'm not doing much running this week, so I've got plenty of time for other diversions. So about myself, so obviously I'm Scottish, you can tell that by the accent, so hence it's a privilege to run the West Highland Way. And I turned 40 actually, so I'm a veteran now. I turned 40 in April this year, so I'm a vet in the running stakes, but I've got two young kids, two boys, one of them turned 9 on Friday before the race. And the other one, he's 5 in August, so two boys. They keep me busy. I'm married to Louise, who is an absolute diamond, who allows me so much time to pursue the running. And I work for Sky, which may become relevant later on, judging by some of the Facebook questions we might have been asked. And you know, work full time, have two young kids, have a family, and I'm quite a busy guy. Live out near a place called Croy, which is near Cumbernauld. Famous for having a couple of little races nearby, the Antonine Trail races, which are good diversions, and I've recently taken over as race director of them, so dipping my toe into the waters that you guys get involved in.
Excellent, thank you. And are you running background? Have you always been a keen runner, or sort of is it just fairly recently?
So I think I did my first marathon in 2001-ish. But I never really ran anywhere near seriously until about 2012. So I've done marathons on and off, maybe done about 10 marathons over 10, 11 years. And then in about 2012, I did my first ultra. And probably about 2013, I decided to explore how good you could be at the running scene and see what the limits of the potential were. So I've ran for a long time, but not ran seriously for very long, just a few years.
And the ultras, what attracted you to running an ultra?
So it's quite funny, I get asked this so often, and there wasn't a thing, and the question implies what thing it attracted you, and it just became a gradual build up. So the background is, in 2011, my and this is true, it's a true story, my second boy was born, August 2011, and there's a picture of me holding them, and I'm about 4 stone heavier than I am now.
Wow.
And really unfit, and I'd run a marathon that year, but I was really, really unfit looking. So I decided to get back into running, but also for the first time to actually try and properly lose weight through it and get fit. So instead of just plodding on through marathons to get a bit fitter. And one thing led to another, read a couple of books on ultra running. And funnily enough, the first time I'd ever heard of ultras in Scotland was when I was running the canal near Croy at Auchinstarrie, and the Glasgow to Edinburgh ultra ran through there, and I was like, that's incredible, people do this thing. And I started to read up about it, and from there it kind of snowballed. Entered the Clydeside in 2012 and had my one and only DNF in that race, and learnt more in that 30 miles of pain than I have in any other race in my life. So it wasn't something that just, I said I must do ultras, it kind of just built from trying to get fit again, and has built from there, and will plateau soon, I'm sure.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure we could chat loads about different races, but obviously keen to sort of talk about Saturday's race. But was the West Highland Way always the race that you wanted to do, and how long have you been sort of planning to take part in it?
So yes, it was always a race. As soon as I get into doing ultras, it was a race you had to do. If you're Scottish and you're an ultra runner and you feel you're capable of running that distance, you have to do the West Highland Way. It's the blue ribbon event of Scottish ultra running, and arguably one of the blue ribbon events of British ultra running, actually. So yeah, absolutely. You read stories of it. It just seemed absolutely impossible in my mind for something I could have done. But as time moved on, yeah, I felt as if it was something I could do. And in November last year, when the ballot opened, I had not long run Glenmore, and I'd won Glenmore last year, and I'd entered Thames Path 100, which was on the 30th of April, same day as the Fling, 2016. But I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do that. And I didn't want to leave the West Highland Way another year if I didn't do Thames Path. So I entered the West Highland Way with a view to deciding before the, you know, you can enter, and then you have the end of December before you have to absolutely formally commit. Entered it with a view of making a decision by the end of December. And when I made that decision, that was me committed to it. So again, almost like the ultra run, built up towards it. But once I was committed to it, it was there to be done as best as I could.
Yeah. And that Thames Path, did you do that one?
No, I didn't. The reason I didn't was I got the call up to run for Scotland in 100k in March.
Right.
And there was no way I would do the 100k in March, then a 100 mile in April. That's just suicide when it comes to your fitness and your body. So it actually became a really neat break in the year, because Thames Path, the Anglo-Celtic Plate and West Highland Way have got just about a perfect gap between them from a training point of view.
Yeah.
And as it played out, in fact, yeah.
And did it go okay, the 100k?
Yeah, I mean, not as well as I would have liked. Had a number of issues on the day. Ran the first half pretty much spot on to plan, and then, as can happen to anyone, regardless of who you are, how fit you are, had some issues with the stomach, which meant various visits to Portaloos, and got my money's worth out of toilet roll, just tailed off in the race. I was a counter for Scotland. I got third place for Scotland, but I know I could do a lot better, which is encouraging in one way.
Right. Okay, so let's go to 1 o'clock on Saturday morning, and you're on the start line in Mulgay. What were your thoughts and what were your plans for the race?
So I had a really, really rock solid plan. I'm coached by Paul Giblin, so that really helps in terms of getting yourself set up for the race. And we talked a couple of times about what the race possibilities were. And 15:30 was my starting plan, knowing that I could go quicker if I had to. And by that, 15:30 was what we felt was a potential race winning plan. So that was what we were going with, and I was pretty cool at the start. I had no nerves, no inhibitions, knew what I had to do. Having done a couple of 24-hour races now, didn't really fear the distance, and I'd seen every step of the course this year. So I was really, really comfortable. Had a good chat with some good friends on the start line, and was raring to go. 1 o'clock start, is not the greatest when it comes to preparation, trying to get sleep and stuff. But once 1 o'clock came, I was wide awake, and it was time to get moving.
Yeah. Now, I know, obviously, I think you listened to the podcast I did with Stuart Mills. And
yeah.
I think he thought that you were one of the four that went off at quite a quick pace. But you were telling me that you weren't, were you? So did you deliberately let those four or five go?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was four guys went off really quick. Stuart being one of them. Adam, Chris Browner. I don't actually know who the fourth person was. And they went off really, really quick. And not quick as in if it was a marathon, they'd be running really easy pace. But we know we've got 95 plus miles ahead of us across really tough terrain in the middle of the night. And I had a time in mind for getting to Drimmen. And I wasn't going to compromise that early. I wasn't going to run anyone else's race early on. Because in my head, if these guys can go and run 15 hours, then great, good on them. You know, they deserve the win. So they went off quite quickly. And I just let them carry on. And myself, Hal Connor, and Davey Gow ran together for a wee while up to the Beech Tree. And then I ran with Hal right through to Drimmen before his knee problem started to play up. And those guys were well ahead of me. In fact, when I got to Connacht Hill, I timed it. I could see the light ahead of me, and I timed it to be 4 minutes that the first light was ahead of me. And the four guys were ahead of me just as I started to get towards the turn that takes you towards Connacht when you go through the gate.
Mm.
But by the time I got to the top of Connacht Hill, I was in second place. So the guys had obviously went off quick, but I ran pretty much all of Connacht rather than walking up it. So different race tactics, different mentalities and stuff. And I get into Drimmen within 50 seconds of my intended plan. So it was the right thing to do. No point in chasing guys down within the first 10 or 12 miles. But no, I wasn't one of Stuart's four that he thought I was yesterday.
Yeah.
He would have known because I would have probably talked the ears off him. Yeah.
And then, so by the time you got into Balmerhard, you were in the leading group then, were you?
I was second by Chris. I think Chris might have been a couple of minutes ahead of me in Balmerhard. And there was myself and someone else who came into Balmerhard pretty much together. And then from Balmerhard, I pretty much ran on my own for the rest of the race, in second place until I overtook Stuart and Chris later on in the race.
Right. And was your tactic in the checkpoints to be in and out pretty quickly?
So actually, I timed it today. I timed it today to see how much time I spent in the checkpoints overall. And the longest I spent in any checkpoint was 177 seconds. And the shortest was 54. And I was 15 minutes overall at the stops. So not just the formal checkpoints, but ones like where you would stop at, say, Victoria Bridge, or if you'd meet your crew somewhere else, like at the bottom of the Devil's Staircase or what have you. So 15 minutes time I'd spent just with my crew, but the rest of it was running. So yeah, definitely, no sitting down, no messing around, eating while walking, drinking while walking, and making the best use of time possible.
Yeah, I'm sure some people, James, listening to this will think, I spent 15 minutes in every checkpoint.
Well, if you want to be the sharp end of the field, you can't give away time for nothing, can you? You've got to just move.
Yeah. So you were saying you're really on your own then from Balmerhart until you caught Chris. So did that feel lonely? Did it feel as though you were still in a race and you were very focused?
So I was very focused. I think the great thing is, apart from the section between Rubber Denon and Ben Glass, when you go quite a while without seeing your crew, you've kind of always got that to look forward to. And I do most of my training, if not probably about 90% of it, on my own anyway. So I'm pretty used to being on my own, on trails, on with my own thoughts. So I was quite cool with that, and just plodding along myself, looking forward to seeing my crew every now and then. But I knew I was in a race because obviously every time I got to the checkpoint, I would get information about where I was. And to be honest with you, as I was running through, I thought Chris was looking really strong. He was well ahead of me. I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 minutes ahead of me, but through Ben Glass. I didn't have the best of times on the lock site. I didn't really enjoy that terrain. So I'd kind of, I maybe was heading towards not being dispirited, but almost started to think that second place was going to be the best I could do on the day.
Yeah.
But those are the thoughts that were starting to go through my head, and that's where the crew becomes essential because they help get me out of it. But yeah, no, I was really comfortable running on my own. I actually enjoy my own company.
Yeah. I'm just looking at the splits here. At Ben Glass, you were 9 minutes behind Chris, and then and at Oak to Tear, you were 10 minutes behind. So you'd almost ran from Ben Glass to Oak to Tear. Your splits are within 20 seconds of each other. You know, so you ran it almost identical. But then by the time you get to Bridge of Orkney, you've got almost a 22-minute lead.
Yeah, so this is what... So I get into Octa Tire, and my crew have said to me, Chris has just gone through and he says he's feeling pretty ropey. And might have used more industrial language than that, actually, from what they relayed to me. I get a real boost from that, right? Because obviously I'm thinking, I don't enjoy the first half of the course as much as the second half. First half's good, but I really like the second half of the course. And Brace Rannick more, Brace Larrick more, I enjoy that. So I was looking forward to the second half of the race, and to hear the guy who's in the lead is starting to struggle, kind of gave me a big boost. And I ran the section from Octa Tire through Tindrum into Bridge at Orkney. I ran really, really well through there, really quick. I would imagine I had the quickest split in the race through that.
Yeah, you did,
I thought so.
No, I was just going to say, you were 1:23, and the next best was 1:29. So you were 6 minutes faster than anybody on that leg.
So I put a move in, because I said to my crew before the race, we've got a pace plan to get ourselves up to Tindrum, and then after that we're in a race. The pace plan becomes a framework, but it doesn't become what we adhere to, because... We knew the pace plan we could run to. That wasn't an issue. The issue was, what was the right thing to do to win the race? So I put a move in between Bridge Orkney, or from Octa Tire to Bridge Orkney, to try and close Chris down. And I don't know the names of all the places on the course, but as we got to about 3 miles from Bridge Orkney, I see Chris ahead of me. And it's a couple of minutes ahead, and I'm closing him down. I know I'm closing him down because he's getting bigger, and I'm chiming it. I'm seeing a tree, and then I'm timing how long it takes me to get to the tree. And my aim was to overtake him before Bridge Orkney, but also when I overtook him, to move fast so that I would dispirit him, hopefully, try to compound how he was feeling as he came into Octa Tire. But then he disappeared. and it turns out he went off course as you go over a couple of stiles. And I thought he just went over the brow of the hill and moved away from me. But 5 minutes later, I was like, I obviously hoped he hadn't went off course. Maybe he had to jump in the bushes for the toilet or something like that. But when I got to Bridge of Orkney, my crew already knew he'd went off course, which was interesting, because at that point you're thinking, now I'm in the lead, I now need to stay in the lead. But you're also feeling a bit sorry for the guy, because he's put 60 miles of really hard effort in, and it's not great. But ultra running is about knowing your course and knowing the route as well as much as anything else. And that put me in the front, and it was about, what's Bridge Orkney, 61 miles in?
Yeah.
So from then on in, it was about staying in front for me.
Yeah, it's interesting again, because to the next section, you were the second fastest to Glencoe, and Adam Zahoran, he was 5 minutes faster than you. So he was, you know, I assume you don't know that, but he is starting to close in a little bit, in that you had 8 minutes on him at Glencoe.
So one of the mistakes we made, and one of the things we take as a learning, was we spent so much time worrying about the guy in front, we forgot to think about the guy behind.
Right.
So I get to, as I'm running through Rannick Moor, I'm thinking, God, I'm in front here. This is amazing. And your mind starts to wrestle with, right, how do I make sure I consolidate this? Because you go from being the hunter to being the hunted.
Yes.
And you know, you go through Rannick Moor and you've got that big, long drag up to Glencoe before you have the downhill towards the ski centre.
Yeah.
And I made a decision to walk that hill. Or to walk most of it and slow down and conserve some energy, because rather than basically to get the energy back I'd used from Octa Tire to Bridge Orkney, so that the 5 minutes I'd made on my pace plan from Octa Tire to Bridge Orkney, I was quite comfortable to give that back, because that would get me back on 15:30 pace, but also means I would get some energy back.
Right.
But what I didn't play into my thinking was that Adam would be behind me closing. And of course, when we get into Glencoe, I get the news that Adam was about 13, 14 minutes behind me at Bridge of Orkney, and I'm thinking that feels quite good, comfortable with that. I'll just crack on and I'll conserve energy up over the Divil, was my thinking as I come out of Glencoe. And that then became a potential issue as I got to Kinloch leaving.
So by the time you got, Kinloch leaving, you were 6 minutes ahead.
I got up over the Divil, and I just fast hiked the Divil and I run down into Kinlochleven. And I'm not going too hard because I don't want to trash the quads into Kinlochleven, because you've obviously got Larry Moore you need to play your way through as well. I meet the crew at that kind of magic quarter of miles point from the checkpoint at Kinlochleven, and they say to me that Adam's closed the gap, he's only 7 or 8 minutes behind me, and in my head I'm going, that he's taken half my gap away from nowhere, and I've gone easy over the Divil, he's going to be not far behind me. And a switch goes in my mind at that point that says, well, you know, you've got two choices here. You can feel sorry for yourself, or you can go and run one of your toughest sections and run as hard as you can for the next couple of hours to win this race. And it became a question of how much I wanted to win the race at that point. So it was in and out of Kinloch leaving, getting weighed, get a bit of some juice and some food in me as quick as I could, and then really attacking Larrick Moore through Llandafra as hard as I could in order to try and put a gap on Adam, which obviously I did. But it was a proper race in my mind at that point. It was touch and go as to whether I would win at Kinloch leaving. I couldn't get information at Llandafra other than Adam had closed the gap a bit further. So it was a real proper race up over Larrick Moore in my head.
Yeah. Well, again, looking at the splits, your final split from Kinloch leaving to Fort William was 2:26, and Adam was 2:36. So you were 10 minutes faster, which meant that you finished 16 and a half minutes ahead of him. So in a sense, it was comfortable by the end, but it didn't, in your mind, I'm sure it didn't feel too comfortable.
No, I got to Llandafra, and I had run Larrick Moore so well, and sometimes you get this way, John, where you go, you know what, I've just ran so well here, and you know how tough Larrick Moore is when you've got 80 odd miles in your legs, and I never walked any of it. Just ran the whole way, and there's a brilliant picture that Thomas took of me as I'm coming to the end of the Larrick Moore coming up towards Llandafra. And I look fresh, and I genuinely feel great. It's almost as if the challenge from Adam reinvigorated me, gave me some energy. I got from Patricia, gave me a bottle of Iron Brew in the middle of Larrick Moore as well, and that was very welcome. You know, Patricia and Jeff were there, and she'd saved a special bottle of Iron Brew for me, and that was really welcome. Boosted from energy from that, and Gail and Alan Tate are sitting at Llandafra with a song called Rearview Mirror by Pearl Jam. Which is the finest running song ever. That's a fact for anyone who's listening. It's a fact. It's the finest running song ever. You should give it a whirl. And that's blasting as I come in. And I just feel totally in control at that point, which is really kind of insane because you're nearly 90 miles in. But I knew if Adam was catching me, then he absolutely deserves it, because of that. I've not only have I put the best effort I can, I actually feel that effort's been better than I thought possible. Yeah. So I get to Llandafra and I'm like, right, okay, we knew Adam had closed a wee bit more into Kinloch leaving, so it was a case of not letting up out of Llandafra, and the challenge in my head was to run the whole hill out of Llandafra if I could, because I knew Adam would struggle to do that, or I expected Adam to struggle to do that, as most people would. And Paul once said to me, Paul Giblin, that is, once said to me, he says, if you're running an ultra late in the race and you're running hills, the chances are you're covering the ground faster than everyone else. And that was in my head as I was boosting up that last hill.
Yeah. So at what point did you feel that you had it in the bag?
When I got to the Braveheart car park, that's when I knew. And the reason being is the section from Llandafra through the forest and into Glen Nevis is a bit tricky. And you could easily fall on your backside through that section, you know, and cause yourself some damage. And coming down the hill, I was running down the hill, I don't know what I was running, maybe close to 7 minute mile or something like that, coming down the hill out of Glen Nevis, and I was running well. And when I got to the car park, I know there's only 2 miles to go, he's going to have had to, he's going to have to run a sub 2 hour half marathon to have caught up with me. So when I get onto the tarmac at Fort William and start heading towards the sports centre, I kind of know then that I've got it won, and it starts to dawn on me that I've got it won, and I've got maybe another, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes worth of running. And I do start to feel it at that point. I'm like, all the emotions can start to come in on you. But it's an amazing feeling, amazing feeling.
So that last mile, did you have people on the route cheering you, or were you still on your own running in that last bit?
I was on my own shouting excuse me to various walkers, you know, with the backpacks and they're walking 3 abreast and stuff. Had to jump up the road a couple of times, but not on my own. All the way down, and then as I got to the roundabout where the old finish was, and you turn the corner there and you can start to see the roof of the sports centre, and I could see my crew were all wearing very, very, very bright yellow t-shirts, which was extremely handy. Jerry Craig was kind enough to give us some t-shirts for the guys to wear, so I could see them off in the distance, and that I knew it was close at that point. So not ran that whole section myself with my own thoughts as well.
And did you have a tear in your eye as you came to the finish?
More a lump in my throat. There was no water left inside me. By the time I got there. But yeah, certainly a lump in my throat. Lots of things went through my head about how proud people would be. And I don't mind saying it, when they think about your crew, the 4 guys out there supporting me, 2 overnight, 2 in the day, and then they pulled up together for the last couple of points. Those guys put in an immense effort and made a lot of sacrifices to help me. So that was my friend Des Tinney, Alan McCush, and Scott Fergus. But the fourth member of the crew was my dad. And it's an extremely proud moment for him, and thinking about how that would feel for him, seeing me come over the line. That started to put a lump in the throat, then thinking about Louise and the 2 boys and how they would feel. And then just the amount of people, John, who cheer you, who send you messages on Facebook, who spend time to say good luck beforehand, and thinking that they are rooting for you, and certainly the messages I've had since have been extremely overwhelming and justifying that feeling I had. So yeah, I don't mind saying there was a lump in my throat. I managed to hold myself together, though. I wasn't like Halle Berry at the Oscars, I was okay in the end. Yeah,
and the great thing is the adventure show, we're filming it, so you'll have a professional tape of you coming into the finish.
I don't even want to see. When I stopped at the end, I was just rambling. I was almost borderline hallucinogenic at that point. I was like, right, what's this big hairy thing you want me to talk into? And it's the microphone, and she's blathering away and asking me questions, and all I want to do is sit down. And obviously it's great, and it's something that I obviously can't wait that it comes on, because it's something you've got to treasure. Make sure I get a DVD of that for sure. But yeah, and as much as it's great that they're filming me, I know they were filming lots of other runners at the course who've got stories which are much more interesting than mine. More importantly as well, the day it was, they'll show the beauty of the West Island Way in all its glory, because the blue skies, the amazing triangle of backdrops into the mountains and the Buchel and all that stuff are just going to look sensational when it comes on.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, you'll have me sweating all over the microphone talking rubbish at the end.
Well, certainly, James, on behalf of the race and everybody else, congratulations. And I think it's always very special when someone like yourself, who's come fairly recently, Paul was very similar in some ways. He came from nowhere and then he won some races and then came through, and he had a few battles in the West Island Way before he won one. He won his first one. But I think we always feel very proud of someone like yourself who's come through and has won the race. So congratulations. And that's brilliant. Now, I put on yesterday that I was going to interview you, and I've got loads of questions here. Well, are you happy just to work through them? And
let's
I was thinking of putting them in some sort of groups, but I think it might be easier just to wade through them. So there'll be some more irrelevant ones and more relevant to running, but we'll see. So the first one was Angela Brin, and she says, can you ask him when he had his last what's it? So you'll need to explain this.
Watsits are, we regularly get in a debate about whether Watsits are potato corn snack or a crisp. which is, you know, kind of arguing whether or not a tomato is a tomato or a tomato is my view. It's a crisp as far as I'm concerned, and I'll take anyone on in that debate. And they were my kryptonite. So I used to run a lot. Sorry, let me rephrase that. Even when I was running a lot before I started to eat a lot better recently, Watsits were an everyday thing. I could easily eat a 12-pack of Watsits on my own in one sitting. But Angela, I haven't had Watsits since I turned 40. So in my 40s, which was 2nd April I turned 40, I had my last bag of Watsits after I ran the Anglo-Celtic Plate for Scotland because Louise had bought me a packet as a treat. So there you go. So it's been, what's that, 2.5 months? Nearly 3 months.
Okay. Yeah. Well done. Okay. Lorna Sinclair says, can you define taper and recovery according to the Stewart School of Thought, please?
Oh, yeah. So taper, my tapers are defined by Paul and the coaching plan he puts together for me. And it's a pretty rapid taper. Train really hard up to 3 weeks out, 2 weeks out from the race. And then it's pretty much a sharp 2 week taper. And that works really well for me. Not a lot of miles, might only run 8 or 9 days across that 2 weeks, but it'll be short runs, one or two sharpers in there, but really just ticking over. And in terms of recovery, it's the thing that, I don't mind going on record as saying it, one of the things that does frustrate me with ultra running is you see people who'll do a long race or do a big effort and then think that they have to go out and post a run on Strava or Garmin Connect or Facebook or something the next day just to show their mettle. Mettle for me is knowing when you have to step back and recover. For example, this week, I won't run any more than twice, maybe only once, and even at that, I'll only do a couple of runs just to eke out any niggles. So much like Marco only runs one, he takes a full week off after a run. I'm borderline taking a full week, but I maybe run 5K on Thursday morning just to see if there's any niggles that I need to get some attention to. And if I'm feeling okay the weekend, I might go out for an hour or so. Nice. And that recovery will incrementally build back up before I start getting into heavy training again. And I did write an article on my blog a while ago about the importance of recovery. But yeah, people should take it seriously. It's one of the most important parts of your training.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. Yeah, and I think you're right. I think sometimes people want to prove how great they are, you know, by running the next day, but it can be counterproductive, yeah. Can it? Okay, Mark Cooper, maybe too vague, but what's his race day fueling foods of choice? And if that's too vague, how the hell did you run it that fast?
How did I run it that fast? There's a couple of questions later about training. I'll cover that off and how training sets you up for that. But in terms of race day fueling, I've had a lot of challenges getting something that works for me over a long period of time. And in a 24-hour race, you can get away with that. So the Glenmore races, when I ran them, I could get away with it because you would stop for a wee while and you weren't going as hard and the train was a bit more consistent. But one thing I've done this year and worked really hard on was moving towards eating more whole foods. So do a lot of home baking, making my own biscuits, flapjacks, and my sister-in-law Alison made the best banana bread ever, which I think I maybe ate 5 slices of it on Saturday. And my next-door neighbour George made sweet potato brownies, which are absolutely brilliant. So eating really nice food like that and some soup, some nice homemade soup as well. And then I dovetail them with things like a Muller rice every now and then and Coke. And the drink that I had at the weekend was Tailwind, which works for me.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. And Mark also says, feet. Mine were shredded and blistered. So how do you keep your feet in good condition to run those loose boulders and rocks towards the end?
I had zero blisters after that race. And I didn't change my shoes and socks once. I may have tough feet and may be lucky, but I found socks and shoes that work for me, and I rarely get any trouble with them, and I touch wood as I say that, but I wear the Liga socks, I think that's how you pronounce it, the South African socks, and I wear Hoka shoes. I was wearing Hoka Challenger ATRs on Saturday, and I should point out that I've recently kind of hooked up with Hoka as one of their ambassadors, so they're kind enough to help provide me with equipment. So when I talk about shoes, put that caveat on there, but I have worn them now for the better part of 3 or 4 years, And they work for me. They're not everyone's cup of tea, but not a single blister, not a single issue with my feet at all. They were sore, but they were not in a bad way at all. Yeah. And I've seen some horrendous pictures.
Yeah. Just on that, have you had some interesting discussions with Paul Giblin about Hokers?
No. Paul's one of the best things about Paul. I mean, Paul's an amazing guy, he's a coach and a friend and we do a lot of things differently. He's a vegan. I love chicken. He's minimalist. We use topos and what have you. I love Hokers. But the main thing that both of us love is we both love working hard and running hard. And that's the thing that unites us and bonds us. We've got different views on things. It's kind of like the equivalent is he maybe likes, you know, European long hair metal, and I'm maybe more a heavy metal man, you know. So we both love music, but we've got different tastes in it. That's the way to look at it.
Right. OK. Matthew Curry says, what was the structure of your training?
So, Matthew, I'm an everyday runner. Yeah, so I run every day, unless there's a need to take a rest day. And I'll run a couple of double days a week, and I'll run varied sessions. And I will do, generally speaking, a long run at the weekend and various tempo and speed sessions through the week, interspersed with easy sessions. And the mileage will be anything up to 110 to 120 a week at the peak of training. And the sessions, I'm again really lucky, I've mentioned it already, being coached by Paul, but he's got a lot of brilliant sessions that bring runners on, and they work really well for me. But yeah, run every day, lots of speed work, lots of tempo work, lots of long runs, but a real emphasis on making sure you've got good solid recovery and easy runs in there and not burning yourself out.
Right. Excellent. Donna Pass asked the question, and Alan Stewart thought this was a great question. And she said, who has the hardest run? A runner like yourself finishing in 15 hours, or those who finish in 32? He says, please and thank you.
So, you know, personally, I don't think I could do the 32-hour thing. And I have massive respect for the guys. And one of the greatest honours of the best MLB is getting to give the last finisher their goblet. So I have probably more respect for the guys who do the 32-hour gig up two nights and going through a second night, having to get the head torch out and having to, you know, go through all that eating and fueling than someone like myself running a 15. I think the effort in the moment for your 15-hour runner is harder. And there was some really interesting debate recently about how 5K is harder than ultra running. For the 15 minutes or 16 minutes you do the 5K, it is harder. But it's the long-term effect of that. And I would say, who's the hardest? I think they're harder in different ways. I think the 32 is so much more mentally demanding than the 15. And kudos to the guys who do that. So I wouldn't like to say my run is harder than those guys, so we'll give them it.
OK, excellent. Lee McLean, can you ask him who gives the best race hugs?
That's a rhetorical question, Lee. It's you, of course. Got a brilliant one at the end of the clip trade, and I got a nice one from Lee as well at the prize giving. Yeah. But in terms of people who are not involved in the races, one of the great things was at this race and at the Celtic Plate and at Glenmore, because he cruised me then, was getting crossing the line and first person there being my dad to give me a hug. So that was a man hug though, not the cool hugs that you get from the likes of Lee.
I think Sarah Self put a comment as well saying, not fair, that everyone knows the answer to that one. So,
yeah, it's Lee McLean, obviously. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Norrie Hunter asks, and again about food, saying that you struggled with nutrition and stomach issues in the UK 100K in Perth, which was helped with some ginger crystals. What else has he changed to avoid a repeat, or indeed, what is his race day nutrition? You've covered some of that, but is there anything else you wanted to mention on?
Yeah, I mean, in simple terms, Norrie, I get about half my calorie intake through the Tailwind. I don't believe, I'm sure Mike and the guys from Tailwind and the guys who invented it would maybe beg to differ, but I don't believe you can run on a race like the rest of the weight, therefore we run it at, on that liquid alone. So I get about half my calorie intake from that, and that agrees with me. The odd splash of Coke on top of that as well, just for a different tasting, but still getting some calories is good. So that's the liquid side with some water sorted out. In terms of food, covered it off already. I had to do something different and focused on home baking and good pure food. So I used to do things like I would have a topic or a snicker or something like that. But really what was happening is that stuff was just wreaking havoc in my stomach. So now by making things like cocoa balls, sweet potato brownies, banana bread and stuff, I feel like I'm eating good healthy food or good pure food where I know the ingredients are nice and solid. And I practiced that a lot in training. I ran Glen Lyon this year so that I could practice my nutrition strategy for the West Island Way. And it took a lot of effort to find the right answer. And if you're having trouble, for anybody who's having trouble out there, stick with it. But I would absolutely advise you to consider making your own stuff because it will work out for you.
Right. That's great. Thank you. Andrew Crichton says, ask him if he can give his big mate, the Stag, a shout.
Oh, big shout to the Stag.
Who's the Stag?
Andy's the Stag. He's one of the top boys around. A great guy, a member of Team Vambo, which is a wee relay team where Andy came along and helped support us on race day where we ran the John Lucas relay. But he's a top boy, Andy. A lot of time for him.
Yeah, because obviously I've been interviewing Andy for his for this year on the podcast. Yeah,
he's a good lad.
Yeah. Okay, Alan Stewart says, can I play him as a 50-year-old when the eagerly awaited Rocky-themed from 10K plod to West Island Way race winner film comes out?
Absolutely, Alan. Absolutely. You and I are probably the two smallest guys in the ultra scene, so we're going to get by okay with that as well. So, yeah, you've got that part nailed down.
Yeah. A good one from David Martin. What do you think about when the pain kicks in? And he's also asking, what make of shoes were you wearing and did you change them during the race to suit the different terrain? So maybe just because you've dealt with the second one, but the first one, what do you think about when the pain kicks in?
It's almost like what I was talking about when you're running into the finish early. You think about the training, the effort you've put in. And I read a book by Charlie Spedden, who you probably remember, won bronze medal for Britain at, I think it was the Los Angeles Olympics.
Yeah.
And he had a mantra, Sarah herself actually was kind enough to loan me this book. And he had three questions that he always asked himself whenever he was in a race was, what do you want? Why do you want it? And how much are you prepared to hurt to get it? And when the pain starts kicking in, that's the questions I start asking myself. What is it I want to do here? I want to win the race. I want to run a certain time. How much do I want it? Well, yeah, you know, I've trained for 6 months. I've been up at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning for weeks. So I want it really, really bad. And how much am I prepared to hurt for it is a question you can only really ask in the moment. But that's what I think about at the time. And I think about all the people who are there supporting. And generally speaking, David, I'm a really positive guy, so I always try and think on the positive side. So when I'm hurting, I generally think I'm not hurting as bad as I think, as bad as I could be at this point. So, and it's not spin; it's just I'm really an optimist. And in fact, there's been lots of studies shown recently that optimists are more likely to push through the pain barrier because they can see the possibility of the outcome rather than worry about the pain of the moment. And that's something I'm exploring just now with reading.
Excellent. Scott Ferguson says, can I ask you about the lab? What is it and why has it been so fundamental to his success?
If you read that question again, the lab, it sounds like some sort of Ivan Drago type thing, like Alan was asking earlier. Yeah. And Scott was one of my crew. So thanks, Scott. The lab is an ash running track in a town called Kilsyth. It's about 390 metres, it's not even 400 metres, and it's an old ash running track that runs around an old football pitch. It's where I do all my speed work. And a lot of the guys who I don't train a lot with other people, but we go down to the lab regularly as a group. And the great thing about it is it doesn't matter whether you're a 10 or 12 minute mile runner or a 5 minute mile runner. We can all train together at the lab. We'll do time sessions and we'll all run the same session and we'll all do it as a group. And generally speaking, I'll be down there lapping the guys I'm with. But it's just the best place in the world because the way we look at it, it's not a smooth track like, say, you go to like Scotland or something like that. It's the kind of track that an ultra runner should train on. And we call it the lab because it's where PBs and wins are made. So that's why it's called the lab.
Excellent. Good. You'll have a whole load of people getting up there for their training sessions now.
listen, if, you know what, we usually go down on a Thursday night. Anyone's welcome to join us.
Great.
Just drop me a line.
Okay, thank you. Richard Longstep, please ask what mode of transport did his support have? Was it a daft wee van or a big camper with all the mod, all mod cons?
It was neither, Richie. It was a... I don't need to drive, right? So I think it was a Vauxhall Sephira overnight and a Mondeo the core day, because the guys have obviously swapped over. So we sound like we were travelling salesmen out for a run. But that was the two cars we had. Nice big boots, that was the main thing.
Yeah.
And the smell in the Zafira from the clothes I'd changed during the race would kill you.
Excellent. Alan Connery, if you could redo your training plan again, what would you do differently?
Honestly, Alan, I had to give feedback to Paul after the race, and the answer to that is nothing. surely there's things you would tweak around the edge here or there, you know, you might do a different minor thing, but in terms of material things, it would make a difference. Absolutely nothing. Paul came up with a training plan, which he refreshed for me every week, that was just absolutely spot on for the race.
Excellent. Amanda Hamilton, what's next on your race calendar? And are there ever any of his pre-work alarm calls to train that he hits the snooze button and goes back to sleep instead of training?
No, I am up before my alarm every morning. I genuinely enjoy training. And in fact, I'm on record as saying to various people, I almost enjoy training more than enjoy racing. I love that time. I'm out, John. I'm out and back before 6 o'clock most mornings, because I go to work at 7 o'clock. So I might have a 13-mile session to do, and I'm out. I might come back in about 6:15 from that, you know, get out the door about, you know, 4:45. Is that time right? Yeah. And I enjoy it. It's fantastic. Amanda, your other question around what's next in the race calendar. Tooting Beck track 24. So could it be any more different from the West End way? I don't think so.
Yeah. And when's that one?
September, yeah.
Right. Amanda also says, and do you do any gym work or yoga, Pilates, anything else in his training plan aside from running?
Yeah, and again, it's encouraged by Paul. Paul put in our plans every week, every day, sorry, strengthen mobility work. And I do my own stretching on top of that. I think I must do anything up to an hour stretching and strength and conditioning work every day. Not core work, sit-ups or squats, some squats and lunges, but not a lot of them. Mainly things that will loosen up the muscles so that you can run and build strength in them the next day. And I have to say, I really found the benefit of that. As you can imagine, John, you're running over Larry Moore and you start kicking stones and you're nearly tripping up and you're fatigued and stuff. And being able to ride those slides and those rocky moments is a testament to that element in the training. If you are serious about running long distance, you have to do that stuff.
And an hour a day?
Yeah, not in it'll be an increment, so it might be 15 minutes in the morning after a run, 30 minutes at lunchtime, 30 minutes at night watching TV. It's amazing how you can do this. You can go on a foam roller for half an hour in front of the TV at night if you want, and that's 30 minutes better spent on a roller than sitting on your backside watching Hollyoaks or whatever else is on TV at night.
Yeah, okay. Jerry Craig, what car should I get when the current one is up for renewal?
Jerry, so you can't get rid of the Jag. That's Jerry. Jerry's been a great friend for a long time. First guy I ever ran with on the West Island Way, Jerry Mark, and I think it was Duncan. I think it was Jerry Mark at Duncan. And they introduced me to it in March 2014. And he's given me a lift in a lot of races and the most comfortable car ever. So if you're going to get something better than the Jag, Jerry, then I'm happy with, but if it's not, just hold on to the car, please.
Excellent. Gavin, Gavin Harvey, I assume this is football. It said, who would win, Team Pylon or Team JGS? And would you play 45 minutes for both sides?
Team Pylon is a name we use for a few of us who are coached by Paul. So Pylon being Paul's, obviously, nickname and coaching name. And Team JGS is Jordan Hill Garden Supplies, Jerry's company. I don't know if I'd play 45 minutes for both sides, but being diplomatic, Gavin, what I'd get is one of those half and half strips. that you used to get in the '80s when Celtic and Rangers played each other, and then I would be just sitting in the middle, and I might referee the match instead of playing in it, given I've got a vested interest.
Excellent. Brendan Rodgers Cassidy, the mental challenge. How does James remain focused for 15 hours? Also, turning the last corner before the finish, can James put into words how that felt?
Yeah, so Brendan obviously covered off how I felt coming into the last corner earlier, and just a torrent of emotions, joy, relief, ecstasy, all of that, all washing over you in one fell swoop. In terms of the mental challenge, because I run most of my runs, including all my long runs, on my own, I find it really easy to be on my own for long times. And believe it or not, having done Glenmore last year and ran 44 I think in there, I kind of wasn't fazed with 15 hours. I kind of was looking at it going, no, that's nice. It's going to be 9 hours less. That's all right. And the way I kept focus was always thinking of the next step. And that might sound a bit twee, but taking a bit of psychology into this, humans worry a lot. If you take the time that they worry, 40% of it's worrying about things that have happened in the past, and play that through a ratio, did I do the right thing at the last checkpoint, who's behind me, what's going on, what's happened here. The 40% of it's worrying about things that are going to happen in the future, but will never happen. So I never think about those things, because there's nothing you can do about either of them. You just need to focus in the moment. And I spend all my time focused on what's happening here and now, and then just thinking about the immediate future, like what I'm going to do at the next checkpoint, what I'm rehearsing the steps into that, and the important things I want to play through to my team. And another thing I do is I have inner monologue. And if anybody who's listening has ever seen Scrubs, I'm a bit like JD in Scrubs, where I've got this inner monologue is on constantly, which I'm sure psychologists would have a field day with, but it works for me. And I constantly play songs through my head, and sometimes challenge myself to get a song start to finish in my head. I don't think I've ever achieved it, but that's okay. I'll get there one day.
Well done. But you were saying earlier you never run with music, do you?
No, I do it on occasion. It depends. I very rarely do. I brought an iPod Shuffle. My intention was to run with it from Bridgeorky to Kinlochleven, but I just didn't bother. I didn't feel the need for it, and I maybe should have. I maybe got through Rannoch Moor a bit quicker in hindsight. But when I go out in the morning, especially in the winter, John, when it's so dark, and if you're going to hit some trails or some dark back roads, you don't really want to be distracted with the music. You need your faculties about you. So I've just got used to running without it. So if I run, say, 9 runs in a week, if I run 1 or 2 of them with music, that's quite a lot.
Right. Okay. Norman McNeil, has any races caught his any races abroad caught his eye, and is he considering doing any?
Oh, Norrie, there's this one called Western States that I will be on the back of getting a place in the, you know, a ticket for the ballot now on the back of the West End Way. But I do have an ambition to run 100 mile in America. There's a couple of them that are considering, and my new best mate Hal said he would help me with some of them, or at least help me with some pointers and ones that would suit me on the basis of what he knows from our conversation. So I'm hoping next year to do 100 mile in America. What one that is, not sure yet, but coming from Croy, even the West Island Way is abroad to me in Norway, you know. So that's outside the postcode district, so that's like a long way away.
Excellent. Wilson Dornan, what took him from a regular runner to a winner?
So, Wilson, it's really simple. It's hard work and dedication, and not just loads of training, doing the right things with the strength and condition stuff we were talking about earlier, your nutrition, a lot of work on mentality, and a big, massive dose of belief on top of that. So it would be easy to pinpoint 1 or 2 things, but it never is. Like any good recipe, there's lots of nuances to it.
Great, thank you. Jacqueline McCormick, what are your top 3 tips, best advice you can give to someone transitioning into ultras? So you apologise if this is a boring and common question, but that's a good one, isn't it?
It it's anything but boring, Jacqueline. And the thing is, if you ask 10 ultra runners for their top three tips, you'd probably get 40 back in response, because you struggle to contain yourself to three. But if I was to try and contain myself to three, the first one I would say is ramp up smoothly. Don't do a marathon and then go and do a 100 miler. Work your way through the distances. You know, do a marathon, work your way up to 50k, build a bit of belief, pick the training up incrementally, not too quick. So that's really important. You absolutely need to nail something that works for you from a nutrition strategy point of view. So as you do half marathons and even marathons, you can get away with eating almost nothing. But once you start running, you know, you can do ultras at your 50k, but they'll be out there for 6 hours. So you need to be able to eat and do that efficiently. So you need to work that strategy out as well. And then the third thing, which is really, really important, and it relates to the question Amanda asked earlier, is you absolutely need to look after your body more than just running. And as you step up to ultras, for me, running becomes, to become a good runner, it becomes a lot more than just running.
Great. Excellent tips there. Right, the next two are about your day job, I think. John Connolly says, what's the best Sky package I can get? And Dunnett Boxing, I don't know if that's his real name, what's the best Sky package me and my brother can get?
So Dunnett is John's brother, Graham. Oh, right. And I have to admit, when I seen these two ask the question, I was dreading it, knowing some of the things that those boys can ask. I think you'll have to give me a call, guys. I need to understand what you've got just now and what's available to you. There's lots of nice deals going on SkyQ just now, so let me know and I'll hook you up with someone who can look after you.
Davey Mooney, do you miss what sits and topics?
Every day, Davey. Every day, more than you can know. and I wish you wouldn't mention it, because it's breaking my heart just thinking about it.
Sarah Self, which race crew, support crew was better, Glenmore 24 or West Harlem Way? And Scott, who as you is Usain is on your team, says fighting talk. So I think you could be in trouble here.
Sarah, that's like asking whether OK Computer or The Bends was the best Radiohead album. The two of them were brilliant, and they had their own little great things about them. And this really laboured and awful analogy, you're The Bends, and The Bends works best at Glenmore, and an OK Computer works best at the West Highland Way. And I just picked the right album for the right day. So I can accept your question at the same time.
A very diplomatic, well done. Okay, Ian Minty, congratulations on a superb run. You're improving rapidly. Do you ever idly dream about the pupil beating the master?
No. I think that would be a pipe dream at this stage. I would love to. Paul was originally scheduled to run in the Anglo-Celtic Plate this team this year, but had to withdraw for a number of reasons in terms of how it sat with him his year and a number of other things. It would be an honour to run alongside him in a race like that, to be in the same team as him. In fact, you could argue with the way we talk about Team Pilot, we are in the same team, but what I mean is to run alongside him would be amazing. Could I ever beat him? I'm happy to continue closing the gap, because if I'm closing the gap on Paul Giblin, I'm doing something right.
Yeah. Excellent. David Waterman, can I have his legs and lungs? In fact, can I just be him, or at least pretend to be him for a day?
So, David, I'm a chubby 40-year-old asthmatic, so I'm not sure you want any of those things. But yeah, you can pretend to be me for a day. I'm working on Saturday at a pay-per-view, so you can pretend to be me on Saturday, and I'll take a day off if that works out for you.
Paul McNair, what touches your soul more, sunrise on Croy Hill or sunrise on Connick Hill?
It has to be Croy Hill. A place where I'll do hill reps in the dark, especially from March through to the end of April when I'm doing those hill reps, and I do them and start in the dark and finish when the sun's coming up. It's just majestic, and the views are amazing. Connick Hill is a beautiful place, but Croy Hill's where my heart is.
Alistair Thompson, what is your next race?
I think you've Tooting Beck, Alistair. Tooting Beck, in September. I might sneak something short in between times just as a sharpener for that, but in terms of a race, that's the one I'll be working for next.
Yeah, just got three more to go. Robert Ferguson, shoes best and not so best, and why?
So, Rob, I've mentioned earlier, I'm a Hoka guy. Have been for a long, long time. I've got in my cupboard about 15 pairs of shoes, and all bar three of them are Hokas. For me, they're best because they give me the support and the cushioning that works for me. They've helped me avoid any injuries. I feel they've played a big part in me not having too much challenge over the last few years, and I've had a pretty unbroken run at it the last couple of years, which has played a part in getting to where I was on Saturday. But they're not for everyone, and by no means would I preach that everyone should run in them. Shoes are a very personal thing, hence why the likes of Paul or other guys, John and Davey, I run with, and Bob, all wear Salomons. For me, the Hokas work best. I don't have a not-so-best shoe, because, again, it's a real personal choice thing. I've had some shoes that I didn't like. Not a big fan of Asics, for example. They don't work for me. Not a big fan of Nikes either. I think they're a bit flimsy. So, but, again, that's a personal thing rather than anything to do with the shoes.
Yeah. Okay. Run we be run, so that is. He says, how long does it take to recover from a race like that after an amazing time? And you did talk a bit about recovery, but anything to add?
There's the recovery week before you can start even contemplating, going back into a mild level of training, but it'll probably be close to 5-6 weeks before I get training back to normal levels again. And that works really fine. I've got, about 12 weeks till Tuttenbeck. So 4 to 6 weeks recovery, and then good 4 to 6 weeks training slot between now and then will be what I'll run with. And as I said earlier, it's really, really important that you take the time to take that recovery. Otherwise, I'll get 4 to 6 weeks in and break down and then miss the most important part of the training towards that race.
Right. Okay. And the last question we've got, Stuart McFarlane. Could you ask him what training he gives his earlobes? Bracket, see his blog if that doesn't make sense.
I wrote in my blog about the race about how even my earlobes were hurting when I got to Kinloch leaving. And Stuart, the issue is I don't give them enough training. That's why they were hurting. So I'm going to chain an anvil up tonight. And I'm going to do some weightlifting via my earlobes and see how that plays out. I might end up looking like an African tribesman with those big giant ears with the holes in them and stuff. But if I get some racing fit, then it's got to be worth it.
Yeah. I must encourage people to read your blog. It's jamesstewart13.com, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. So you've already got your race report up there and it's well worth a read. So I encourage people to go to that, jamesstewart13.com. And they can read your thoughts on the race and how it went. Anything else you want to add as we finish? It's been great chatting to you, and thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and how the race went.
No, I mean, in terms of the finish, so thanks for inviting me along. It's nice to be able to share this with them, with the West Ham away team and the family that you guys all know and love so well. And to finish, it's an honour to sit here as the West Ham away race champion, having followed in the footsteps of not just Paul, who I've got an immense amount of respect for, but there's some, looking at the plate as it sits up in my living room just now, we moved the kids' pictures, genuinely moved the kids' pictures earlier on so that we could get the plate up, because also that's important. I mean, the kids are here forever, right? I might only have the plate for a year. To have that sitting in the house, and Richie Cunningham said to me, put it somewhere you can see it every day, because it's got magical powers. It's an immense honour which hasn't truly sunk in yet, and I'm extremely, extremely proud to be part of the history of the race now. I hope I get the opportunity to do it again sometime in the future.
Yeah.
So thanks to Ian and everybody and his team and the committee for putting on such a fantastic event and allowing all of us who took part, all 1,000 or 1,100 finishers who have ever finished the race now, to be part of it, but especially for allowing me the opportunity to win such a prestigious race.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you very much. And we look forward to seeing you defend it next year or whenever you come back to run it again. But it was a tremendous performance. As I said, lots of people were cheering you on and felt very proud of the fact that you did just an amazing time and won such a great race. So well done.
Thank you. Thank you so much, John.
you enjoyed that interview with James Stewart as much as I did chatting to him. A real insight into the race and also his training and preparation, and to be honest, just how hard he works to be able to achieve that goal and to be able to run like that. There will be another podcast coming out in a few days as well, because I've lined up to chat to the two Davids and Andy after their race. That's on Thursday night, so I'll try and get that out. The reason I want to get these out this week is that next week I'm up in Inverness and Thurso visiting family, and then doing the Great Glen race at the end in 10 days' time or so. So I thought it'd be good to get it out this week so people can listen to them. So I hope you, if you've done the race, that you're recovering well and you're taking James' advice and getting a little bit of rest and not getting back into running too soon. And those of you who were involved in the race but didn't run, maybe you're already starting to think about, is that something I could do? And hopefully these podcasts will help you in your preparation. So I'm just going to finish with another quote from Wombat Fitness on Facebook. And this one is from Bono. And he says, "My heroes are the ones who survived doing it wrong, who made mistakes, but recovered from them."